This is John Abrams, and this is The Variety Artist, episode 40. Before doing this interview, I wrote on my Facebook group that you can ask my guest any question you like. Paul Romani responded. He didn't have a question, but I think he put it best. Here's what he said. I have attended Ben's lecture and saw a room full of tired magicians stand on their feet at the end in admiration. His lecture had us all on the edge of our seats. Even the young magicians who sat through the entire convention on their phones playing games put their phones down for his lecture. He has us all in the palm of his hands. I can't wait for this interview. He's probably the best speaker I've heard.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
He's a master magician that's performed all over the world. He's an acclaimed author and historian about to release his 14th book. An adventurer, philosopher, and producer, variety artist, I give you Ben Robinson.
Hello, everyone.
How's it going, Ben?
It's going fine. We're here in the dead center of New York City tonight.
And I'm in the dead center of Southern California.
Fantastic. Let's take the country.
Let's do it. Now, for folks that have never seen you perform, what kind of performance do you do?
I'm a modern Nate Leipzig. I do very small things on very large stages and get paid very well for it. The beginning of my act is the same beginning of Leipzig's act, which he did the multiplying thimbles. Today, if you walked on the street and said, hey, do you know what a thimble is? They'd look at you and walk away. Or they'd say, oh, you mean that thing in Monopoly? No one knows what a thimble is. So what I did was I changed it to finger rings. Mm. Apparently, Eddie Dawes did a search through only 460 years of magic history. And it seems, I'm not saying I am, but it seems that I am the first person to ever make 10 rings appear on 10 fingers.
Yeah, and you can see that on your promo shot on my Facebook page. And you can see all 10 of those rings. It's quite spectacular.
Thank you. And everybody on the planet Earth knows what a ring is.
Yeah.
Would you like to hear a cool show business story about the multiplying finger rings?
Please.
I've been hiding in the music business for 30 years. So I've worked with everybody from Radiohead to Johnny Cash to Pete Seeger, the Clearwater Festival, all these things. I work in places where they don't have other magicians. You see, my concept as a magician is that it should be special, that you should come upon it and it's a singular thing. I'm not damning variety shows or magic shows that have lots of magicians. That's just not my thing. I like to be the only guy.
Yeah.
I was working at a place on 42nd Street in Manhattan called B.B. King's, a long, narrow room, held about 400 or 500 people. The band playing is some friends of mine called the Jazz Mandolin Project. I approached the leader and I just really completed the multiplying finger rings. And I said, you know, I've listened to 12 different pieces of your music and I can do this act if you play any one of those 12 songs. So they talked about it and they say, okay, fine. We work it out that the mandolinist is going to gesture off stage. I'm going to come on, do the act. They get the groove going. I finish, big finale, 10 rings on 10 fingers. Applause. I walk off. They finish the tune. They announce my name. I come back on for another bow and then I leave and the show goes on. And that's what happened. So now it's maybe a half hour after the show and we're all up in the green room. And at one point, a guy taps me on my shoulder and he goes, hey, are you the ring guy? And I say, of course, yes, I'm the ring guy. And he says, my name's Tony. Nice to meet you. I say, hey, Tony, what's going on? And he says, I just want to give you a little piece of constructive criticism. I loved your act. I just wish the rings sparkled. Oh. And I thought, because they were just silver bands at that time. Now, silver on stage reflects black.
Ah.
And we tried everything. Swarovski crystals and glitter and sequins and glue and made a mess and destroyed rings. And we just, 10 years later.
Huh.
My wife and I were walking Greenwich Village and we saw the ring. It was fully formed. It was exactly my ring, except studded with black diamonds. We walked in and said, how much is that ring? And we walked out saying, well, that was a good idea.
Because you have to buy 10 of them.
Yeah, or it takes 11 to do an act with 10. We ultimately acquired all the rings.
Oh.
Well, I went to go find this guy, Tony. right? It's 10 years later. And I knew my friend Jamie with the band. So I was like, dude, we did it. They sparkle.
Yeah.
It turned out it was Anthony Tomasini, the lead editor of Rolling Stone.
Oh.
I never spoke to him again. But if he hears this podcast, I have to say, Mr. Tomasini, grazie, grazie, bella, grazie.
Hopefully he'll call and say you're welcome.
John, this is kind of endemic of my career. I had what I would consider a significant meeting with Katharine Hepburn.
Oh.
The reason I mention Kate now in this interview is because I didn't plan to meet her. But, you know, it was never politically positioned for success.
So how did you meet Katharine Hepburn then?
Well, in 1994, I had had a tumultuous breakup with a fiance,
mm-hmm.
was left $60,000 in debt and homeless in New York City. So yeah, a good place to be in November of 93, live that way till February of 94. Now I wasn't exactly eating trash out of garbage cans, but I was very depressed. The depression came to an end and I got myself a swank little pad in a very nice area of New York City. And for a while, I was just living there without any furniture or anything because the snow was so high, my moving truck couldn't get in.
Mm.
It was just me in the four walls and I was going a little nuts. First, not having a residence and sleeping on people's couches and under the occasional bridge. And then having my own apartment, but with nothing in it. It was like, it's Groucho's joke. I worked my way from nothing to an extreme state of poverty.
Oh, yeah.
So I was living this way and I thought, okay, screw it. I've got to get some sanity here. And I went out to the Paris Theater.
Mm-hmm.
It was Valentine's Day, 1994. And I go up to the balcony. And as I get to the balcony, I see this great shaking bun of gray hair sitting in the seat I want to sit in. And from 60 feet away, I could tell, oh my God, that's Katharine Hepburn. So I thought, you know, what do I do? What do I do? And I thought, well, nothing. I mean, what are you going to do? Jostle her? And
yeah, is she in your seat?
She's in the seat I want. Oh. So I decide I'll sit two rows behind her. So it's the front row with no one in front, then an empty row, and then me. At the end of the movie, the lights come up. It was Woody Allen's movie, Alice.
Yep.
So I bound over the seat in front of me. So now I'm standing directly behind her. And she's standing up. And her jacket is on the chair. So like only 100,000 other men in her life, a complete stranger picked up her jacket to help her on with it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, thank you, dear. And that was it. We were off to the races. She says, you know, what is your name? And I said, what'd you think of the movie? And we just started talking. And when I told her I was a magician, I swear to you, she said, oh, we, Spencer and I saw John Calvert when he first came to Hollywood.
Nice.
Now she's talking my language. I knew John Calvert very, very well. Miss Hepburn and I walked together, she taking my arm. She was with an older couple that was on each side of her, sort of her driver and her friend or whoever they were. And
mm-hmm.
So we walked down the steps and there's the 4 p.m. show waiting to get in. And it was, I hope I'm not offending anybody by saying this, it was truly a Jesus of Nazareth moment. I mean, the crowds just parted when they saw Katharine Hepburn coming down the staircase.
Yeah.
A homeless guy who had been begging porters on the line. He opened the glass door of the theater so we could walk out through it. Then the guy said, have you got her? Have you got her? And I said, yes, I have her. And he said, I'm going to go fetch the car. And so he went and got this station wagon. And he said, I'll take it from here. And they guided her into the back seat of the car and they shut the door. And then the wife got in the passenger seat in the front and the guy got in the driver's seat. And I swear on everything I hold sacred, Kate looked at me from the back seat. She winked, and then the car took off. And I fell to my knees. I was like, it's never going to be better than that.
Yeah.
I've never planned to meet anybody. The one person I did want to meet, because I had a wicked crush on her from Annie Hall, was, of course, Diane Keaton. I mean,
of course.
What red-blooded male in 1975 wasn't in love with Diane Keaton?
Yeah. I was young, but I was also in love with her.
The definition of charming. And one day I was at a a dinner party, and there was a director that I'd worked with on a show, and she was meeting another director, and it was these two women directors complaining to each other about how difficult their lives were with their projects. Mm-hmm. And it turned out the other director was a woman, Joyce Chopra, who was directing Diane Keaton in the movie called The Lemon Sisters. And lo and behold, they needed a magician to train her to pull a rabbit out of a hat.
Coincidentally, you just happen to know one.
I did. And had done it in a show recently and had tape on it. And
well, let's switch gears here. Let's talk about your writing.
Okay.
I want to talk about your first book ever, 12 Have Died.
Yes, sir.
What inspired you to do that? Well, first, before we do it, tell us what it is.
Okay. The book is called 12 Have Died, Bullet Catching Mysterian Secrets. It is the history and retinue of secrets attendant to the following act. A man has his mouth inspected. It's empty. He stands away from a gun. Another person takes a bullet. A bullet is two pieces, a lead and a shell casing, sometimes made out of brass. They mark the brass part of the bullet. They mark the lead part of the bullet, which will be ejected when the rifle fires. And they put that marked bullet in the gun. They close the chamber. They aim at the magician's mouth. They fire when the magician says so. Sometimes it goes through glass. Sometimes it goes through a plate, it shatters. And then in between the magician's teeth is the marked bullet that was fired from the gun. And this has gone on for hundreds of years, and high-powered rifles, and basically what magicians figured out many, 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 many years ago was how the perceptual shift of something so dangerous could be made into a little play about death and resurrection. The gun is fired. It's a real gun. This is not fooling around, because people have been killed. Now, albeit they've been killed by accidents and treachery and people putting things in the gun that shouldn't have been in there, and just got injured because of that. I've been injured 3 times doing it. But the impetus for writing the book was not to write a book. I was going to do the stunt in New York City on Halloween. And my partner, the guy that helped me put the bullet catch together, was a guy named Larry White. And Larry said, "Ben, you know, you're about to go out, you're about to do this, but you've got to turn this into a book." I had done a significant amount of traveling to about 6 different countries to go into libraries, which is the only, seems so archaic now, but it was the only way to do that kind of thing, that if somebody had a newspaper from 1858 and I knew some guy had been playing that town in 1858, I went to that town to pull that newspaper from 1858 to see what I could find out about that magician's performance. And I did this repeatedly, and I have like 4-foot-high stack of paper of notes about stuff like this. Well, anyway, Larry said, "You got to make that into a book." And I said, "What, for the 2 people that'll read it, you and me?" And he said, "No, in case you get killed, we'll want to know where you went wrong."
Okay. Said,
"Thanks for the vote of confidence, buddy." So I had paid a police mechanic to meet me on a firing range in Staten Island at 6:30 in the morning to start firing rounds in my general direction so I could get used to being shot at.
Okay.
And no, this is insanity. I mean, these are live rounds. I've had a piece of my ear taken off. Well, what had happened was I'd hoped to become engaged to my girlfriend of 4 years. I was going to ask her to marry me. And the night I asked her to marry me, she said she had news for me too. And I said, "Well, you go first." And she said, "I don't think we should see each other anymore."
Oh, thanks.
So on the night I was going to ask her to marry me, she dumps me. And I just was like a hot glass put under cold water. I just, boom, shattered. I got this magazine in the mail from the IBM called Blinking Ring.
Yep.
And had a magician named Orville Meyer on the cover, who had developed a really super amazing bullet catch. It's called the Modern Method, frankly. And I read this story on him, and I wrote him a letter, and I said, "I think there's a book in here about everything you've done." And he wrote back and he said, "I'm sorry I ever invented it. People have been hurt. Anneman made a big thing with it, but it's over and I don't want anything to do it. I'm 84 and leave me alone." And then he wrote, "P.S. But interestingly enough, I got another letter from another guy who said the exact same thing you said."
Oh.
and I think you two might want to be in touch. So here's his address. And that was Larry White.
Oh.
And I ended up working with him for 25 years.
On more than that book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we did. We invented a police barrier. You know those two sawhorses with a 10x2 between it says do not cross. So I thought, well, of course, what a magician would do with this is just walk right through it.
Yeah.
You know, he would do what the thing says it can't do. And I said, the budget is $1,000, which is not a lot for a stage illusion. And he did it. And we did it on stage in a show called Out of Order 30 years ago.
Mm.
And it was kind of my beginnings on stage. I've done 9 one-man shows since. We just did one in Canada called Truth and Illusion. You know, I mentioned Leipzig. At the end of Leipzig's career, he was doing two illusions, that one that worked great for most of his life, and the other that he tried a couple of times and didn't really work out. And the one that worked great was when he rolled coins across his fingers. He then had a film shown at the top of the proscenium that showed his hands, you know, 6 feet tall, rolling the coins. People went crazy that that was what he was doing. Mm. It was like video enhancement, but in 1912.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, people generally don't know that he did this, but this is in fact what he did. And of course, he just had to bring a reel of film and say, project this when I start rolling the coins.
Yeah.
Very simple, but Thurston didn't even do that in 1912.
They're doing that now in AGT.
That's right. So nothing's new anyway. But the one that didn't work for him was where he walked away from his shadow. You see this in movies of people tap dancing with their shadow. And
yeah.
The guy walks away and the shadow does something else. Well, they tried that on stage and it wasn't up to the snuff of the rest of his act. So my shadow thing, or actually I should say my rolling the coins thing was an illusion that Larry developed called the trisection, which you see other magicians doing today. But in 1987, I brought it to the stage and had it exclusively for 7 years. No other magician on the earth was cutting his arm into three pieces. In my version, the hand walked away from my body and conducted an orchestra. And it's really super clean. I mean, I won't mention his name because he's a prick, but... please leave that in because it's dickweed. Anyway, I licensed it to another magician who took it around the world and everybody copied him and it ruined it. And then, of course, I get accused of copying him when he got it from me originally.
Of course, it's whoever makes it famous first.
Exactly. And so, but my point is, I became very independent at a very young age and had some extremely bizarre experiences, which are mentioned in my new book called Hiding in Plain Sight.
You know what? Since we brought that up, let's jump in
that
there.
Just happened to fall into the conversation.
Yeah. So your new book, since we already talked about your first book, which is 12 Have Died.
Right.
And there have been, let's see, 12 in between,
right? Yeah.
And now you have your new one, Hiding in Plain Sight. I got to tell you, I love that you wrote this to me. When you wrote on my messenger, it's about heightened awareness, but if you want to read about porn stars, a UFO encounter, a new take on the Kennedy assassination, and then I wrote, then this is for you. So tell me what's happening with this. It's about heightened awareness and all.
What is this book about? What madness are you spewing, Mr. Robinson?
Yeah.
Well, it really works like this. The three things, by the way, the porn stars, the UFO encounter, and the Kennedy assassination are not all linked.
Well, yeah, I kind of figured that they were separate items. Oh,
yeah, they are. I want to make that clear to our listeners. Okay, we'll do them in, I don't even know if it's chronological order. I'll just tick them off. Okay, heightened awareness. It's seeing reality very, very clearly. And often without a lot of information.
Mm.
This is like an animal knowing the tsunami's coming and running for higher ground. That's what we're talking about. Heightened awareness.
Now, gotcha.
How does this move into UFOs, porn stars, and the Kennedy assassination?
It was all, we were all serious for a minute. And now.
Exactly. Now let's jazz it up. Yeah. Well, it turns out the book is called Hiding in Plain Sight because I say, I want to make you aware of a part of reality that you might not be aware of. It's basically expanding your mind. So let's start with, let's take porn stars for 20, shall we?
Yes.
I have a friend who's a very well-known porn star, and I won't mention her name. I wrote some publicity for her, and it ended up getting her a big contract over $250,000.
Nice.
And we got to know each other a little bit. I've never met her in person. We've just talked. Now, the reality of who this person is and where they come from to what they do on the screen is night and day.
Mm.
My friend is a vegan. Not that that would matter on camera. A vegan is making the choice of not to slaughter. It's a daily practice of peace to not eat your fellow animals, right?
Right. Not put that energy in your own body.
That's right. Whereas on camera, she's a very busy person, shall we say. So she's the exact opposite. On top of that, you may say, oh, look at this little promiscuous person. When in fact, both her parents were killed when she was 3.
Oh.
And she was bounced around in foster care homes until she was 17. I don't know that she had terrible experiences there, but she had no upbringing whatsoever. So, oh, what happened? Empirical freeness, awareness. In other words, she was fully aware of who she was and what she was doing on the earth before she ever decided, okay, I'm going to take off my clothes and get paid for it.
Uh-huh.
So the inspection of porn stars shows the genuine reality of their lives. My friend, again, had to be trained by a personal bodyguard in how to handle a gun because her life was threatened many, 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 many times.
I'm sure.
By stalkers who would see her at conventions and follow her to the parking lot and think that a whore can't be raped and things like that.
Wow.
This is diametric other side of the moon stuff from how they appear in public. So heightened awareness. Okay. Now let's move to the Kennedy assassination.
Okay.
If you can hark back to when you were a child and you discovered for the very first time that your parents may have made you, that all of a sudden it kind of crossed your head that, wait a minute, do I live because you guys did, like, what did you, and you start to wonder, like, gee, it's not just all about me and I have bodily functions and I'm a baby, but actually now I'm part of something. So your awareness of something has grown just based on the development of your brain. So how does this get to Kennedy? Well, yeah. Can you expand your mind to the idea that not one person, but potentially many people knew what was going to happen before it happened? Yet, those people who knew it didn't know what they knew. Now, you can say, Ben, you're talking in circles, and I don't mean to, but just like the animal knows how to swim, never having jumped in the water before, they know how to swim.
Yep.
All right. I'm saying that the same ability in the human animal manifested during the Kennedy assassination. And in the book, I don't want to give you the whole story.
Of course. But
the book begins with a story of fact, because I was there and I experienced it. And I'm not lying. I'm not creating up a story. It is a magician to create controversy. This happened.
Wait. Back up a little bit.
Yeah.
You said you were actually there?
Oh, let's clarify this. I wasn't there at the Kennedy assassination. I wasn't in Dallas. No. I was not there. I was alive on the day before when I knew something that I couldn't have known. And I told it to somebody. And they said, you know, a three-year-old is telling me this. What do you do with that?
Yeah.
If your three-year-old came to you and said, hi, the moon man just talked to me and he wants to meet you in the backyard tomorrow night at 5.
Great. Go get your ice cream.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I've had 50 years to think about this. The reason I talk about this is that when I was 3 years old, I had a UFO encounter.
Oh.
Me. I was the one. And it was classic to the form of I didn't know what was happening, but I was scared out of my wits. And I did see something in the sky, and it wasn't, you know, bouncing around like a dot of light miles away. This thing was, you know, I didn't measure it, but it was as close as the aerial on the top of the house.
Hmm.
And it was about 100 yards long.
Wow.
Do you know Magritte's paintings at all?
No.
Well, Magritte draws, you know, a very soft pasture in Switzerland and a man in a bowler hat and everybody's walking. Yet in the air is this giant metallic, what he called his bells. And you look at this and you say, why is that giant ball bearing in the sky during this placid little scene? And that's exactly what I saw. Now, people are going to look at me and say, okay, Ben, you are cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. There's a phenomenon that has happened to me for more than 30 years. Many other people have seen it. Pennies appear around me.
Is that right?
And I don't mean like on the ground, on the sidewalk. I mean, like I've been climbing at Mount Everest at 16,800 feet. And it's a stiff slope and it's ice climbing. And it's, if you don't make the next foothold and you're exhausted and you're wet and you're tired, you are going down, Jack, and it's going to hurt when you land. And I have had that experience of missing my foothold, sliding 30, 40 feet. And now I'm at 16,800 feet in the bottom of a crevasse. And I'm going to dig my way out again. And I turn to my right and there's a penny.
Oh,
I did a wedding for this family called Donnelly, and they published the Yellow Pages, and they had this unbelievable estate in the Chicago area or somewhere in Illinois. And so I go, and you know, it's their closest 3,000 friends, and I'm doing strolling magic. And then I go to the microphone to introduce the bridegroom, and I'm going to do the ring and the wand with the bride and groom.
Okay.
And I go to the microphone. I've done a mic check with the sound guys and everything's set, you know, very professional. And I go and I click on the mic and the mic's not working. And the sound guy says, oh, just a minute. Maybe we have to change the battery. So he runs on stage. And now it's one of these indelicate little moments. And he unscrews the mic and a penny falls out.
That's strange.
There are so many examples. The greatest example was I was being interviewed for a paper called The Brooklyn Eagle and Its Last Gasps. Or maybe it was a resurrection. No. It wasn't The Brooklyn Eagle. Sorry, that was an ancient paper. It was the New York Sun. I think it was a weekly or something. Anyway, they sent a reporter. And so I'm telling him exactly what I just told you. And he's completely incredulous. Now, we are sitting facing each other in two chairs. No tables are near us. My hands are away from my body. You could say, ah, he's a magician. He manipulates coins. But I didn't go near this guy, and he knows it. And I'm telling him this. I'm saying, yeah, pennies appear. I'm talking about form, matter, blipping into space. I know it sounds crazy, but it happens. He goes, well, I find this incredible, Mr. Robinson, that you would lie so bold-facedly right to me.
Oh.
You have no defense of this. You're wasting my time. And I said, well, what about the penny in your hand? He said, what do you mean? He was holding a pen in his hand. He opened his hand. There was a penny in.
Oh. Have you connected that to your life somehow?
Yes. Or
does that mean something to you?
Yes. Yes. It's a language. And we're going way out here, John.
I know. I know. It's like the Variety Artist Podcast. It's magic. It's juggling.
It is crickets out there, buddy. No one's listening anymore.
I'm fascinated by this.
Listen, I could be sleeping right now. I'm telling you the truth. It's reminding me of what I am, which is a magician. You can take that many different ways. My job as a magician, the way that I see it, is to inspire the feeling that I get when I find a penny. When I find a penny, I'm always surprised because it always seems to be winking at me in a strange, poetic, metaphorically stated way. It's like, hi, I'm here. You didn't see that coming, did you? And that's exactly what a magician does. If we don't fool our audience, then we're not really doing our job. I'm a person, and I say this as humbly as I possibly can, truthfully, I did what I set out to do. from a very early age.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the TV when I was seven, Fred Capps, the Dutch Grand Prix winning master magician. And I saw it. My mother said, "Man, how do you do that?" And I just turned to the screen and I turned back to my mother. I said, "Mom, that's me." Now, I wasn't saying I'm Fred Capps. I was saying I'm going to be a magician. I just knew it.
Mm.
I knew it as clearly as you and I are on the phone together. You know, it was empirical. There was nothing fantastical about it. It was like, oh, well, there's a shoe on the ground. I'll pick up the shoe. Oh, there's a magician. That's me. Now, how did I know that? I don't know how I knew that. That's what I'm talking about. When you just know something.
Sure. It's that heightened awareness that you're talking about.
Exactly. Now you're getting it.
What will you be doing at the world premiere on December 20th at the Foundry in Athens?
Okay, you're the best. The Foundry was a Foundry. It's now a big nightclub. It seats a couple hundred people. All the seats are great. They have a balcony, killer stage. I'm working with a group called the Athens Train.
Mm-hmm.
I go on at 7:30. They go on at 8. I will come on and do my act, which is really the opening and closing of my show, Truth and Illusion.
Huh.
Can I take 2 minutes and tell you of another wacky adventure of mine?
Please. Does it have to do with knife throwing?
Yes, this is it.
In fact, I wanted to hear about your knife throwing because right before we got on here, I was looking at your Facebook and you had posted a video of your knife throwing.
I did that for you specifically.
Well, I appreciate that. And now I am asking you about it. So tell me about your knife throwing, Ben Robinson.
Here's what happened. I really got into knives and throwing knives a long time ago, but I didn't know what I was doing. I just sort of chucked the knife and make it stick or try to do it rotationally. And I had the following idea. I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could throw all the cards in the air and then throw the knife and pin the selected card to the wall?
Mm-hmm.
I went on the internet and I went to YouTube and I just typed in knife throwing. There's a guy, he's the Muhammad Ali of knife throwing. His name is Adam Chelidin. He's a lovely guy in the Czech Republic. And he has only 600 videos on YouTube. So I started watching these things and just was absolutely spellbound at what he did. I then bought knives on eBay, which are just small little knife, light sort of letter opener looking things, but they do fly and you can stick them. But it's not really knife throwing. It's more like letter opener throwing into cardboard. And I went as far as I could with that. I joined a Facebook group about knife throwing and I had been searching on YouTube. Sure enough, I found that a guy on Facebook was a guy I had been watching on YouTube, and his name is Jason Willard Johnson. Mm-hmm. And Jason is a modern master of what is called combat knife throwing, which is basically if you're swinging from a vine as a special ops guy and you've been seen before you want to be, and you are close enough, you are going to use that knife silently to take out your assailant.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, these guys are the real deal ninjas. So what Jason did in his videos was he picked up a can, like a soda can, you know, a Coke can or something.
Yeah.
And he's in his garage and there's a wooden wall maybe 25 feet away. And he picks up the can and he throws it, he just sort of lobs it, tosses it at the wall. And he takes a big Bowie knife and throws it spinning in the air and pins the can to the wall.
All of a sudden, lights go off. You're like, oh, my goodness.
It's like, he's done it. He's hit something in flight. That's my idea. How could I learn to do that? So what happened was I was invited to be a spectator at the International Knife Throwers Hall of Fame in Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Jason, coincidentally. And I walked up to him and I said, "You're Jason Johnson." He said, "Yes, I am." And I said, "My name is Ben Robinson." He said, "I've heard the name." And
uh-huh.
I just said, "Do you teach?" He said, "Well, you know, why? I just saw you throw a knife. You know how to throw a knife." And I said, "Well, you see, there's this thing I'm interested in doing and I want to talk about here." We talked on the phone. We created a contract. And in January of this year, I flew out to Omaha, where he lives, and studied with him in his studio for, you know, boot camp. This was 10 hours a day, 3 days in a row. At the end of those 3 days, something genuinely miraculous happened. Jason says, Ben, pick up one of those three of spades off the floor and tack it to the wall.
Mm.
I do. And then he says, now, give me your phone. I'm going to video this throw. He says, okay, this is it. Do it. And that was all he said. Now, this is after nearly 30 hours of throwing over 3 days. So go throw a baseball 30 hours in 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
You know, your arm is going to be oatmeal. And indeed, mine was. But yet, I kind of felt like he knew what he was talking about. And I had been doing really well. I kind of got my groove on. So he says, okay, rolling. So he's rolling with my iPhone. I just walk up to the line, raise the knife, throw it, and I hit the exact dead center of the three of spades. I mean, the dead center. And I knew I was going to do it. And then he stops the thing, shows it to me. He shot it in slow-mo. And then they said, congratulations, you've just taken your first step into a much larger world.
Oh, man.
We are talking about muscle memory and skill for sure, but we are also talking about heightened awareness.
A lot of people would be calling that, or I actually call it being in the zone.
Exactly.
If you use it for basketball purposes, or sports purposes, why does a guy miss seven shots and then all of a sudden he hits 4 3-pointers in a row?
That's right.
It has nothing to do with necessarily muscle memory, or it has to be with his relationship with what's going on at that moment.
He feels it. Derek Jeter said at the age of 14, I want to be the shortstop for the New York Yankees.
Mm.
Well, there's only one job. First of all, you have to get to the majors. Then you got to get to the Yankees.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most impossible road to possibly get to, much less get to and stay at for 20 years, exiting as a multi-gazillionaire Hall of Famer with not one single blemish on his career of a scandal. Yeah. This is like a comic book. You're talking about a superhero.
Yeah.
Now we get into why. Why is Derek Jeter like that? Why was Steve Jobs possessed? You expand your mind. You create what we're calling heightened awareness. The world is going to be bigger and more plentiful to you. My goal, when I said I was 7, I said, Mom, that's me. I'm going to be a professional magician.
Hmm.
Sure. You want to play the game, the headline game?
Yeah. I should have said that, huh? Yeah, let's play fact or something John just made up.
All right, let's do this.
Is it fact? Or is it something John just made up?
Okay, so here's what's going to happen. I'm going to read a headline. You tell me if it's true or not. And if it is true, tell me a little story about it.
I will.
I have a feeling you just might tell me a story about it.
I just might have a story. Mr. UFO Kennedy assassination. Go ahead.
All right, here we go. First headline. When Ben was 4 years old, he jumped off a moving horse.
That is true.
Oh, and tell me about that.
My father was a horseman, and in the last years of his life, he imported the first miniature horse to the North American continent. Full-grown miniature horse, 33 inches high.
Mm.
So at the age of 4, he had me on I think it's called a line or a lead, and this attaches to the horse's harness around their head. And I was on the horse bareback, and he had the lead at about 6 feet, and he was running Carlos, my little horse, in a circle. And then he would let out more lead until I was about at 30 feet. And Carlos is running and running around, and I'm holding on to his mane, no saddle. Because he let out the lead to about 23 feet, we were in a riding ring. I was now maybe 4 or 5 feet from this wooden post wall that was made out of sort of railroad track tie kind of wood, very splintery and terrible. I was just scared. My father was laughing somewhat sadistically, like, hold on, Ben. Oh, he's going fast now. Oh, my.
Isn't that hilarious?
I was terrified of falling off and being trampled, kicked in the head. And I just basically said, screw this. And I jumped from the horse to attach myself to the fence, which is made out of these poles, and a huge shards of wood in my hand. I mean, I was impaled on this thing. And my father said, why did you do that? You could have hurt yourself. I said, I did hurt myself. And he said, why did you do it? I said, why did you have me running around the ring at 45 miles an hour? I mean, that wasn't pleasant. You seemed to think that was very funny, but so anyway, but that was
the story.
That was a story.
Okay, I have a splinter story I have to tell.
Tell.
It's not quite as dramatic as yours.
It's all right.
So when I was a kid, I was a competitive swimmer. I went to a swim meet to watch some of my friends swim. And we were sitting on, back then in the early 70s, all the bleachers were made of wood. I decided while I was cheering somebody on to scooch to one side. You know the rest of that story. A huge splinter went right into one of my cheeks.
Ouch.
So my parents I think it was my mom at the time, had to take me down to the hospital to get a splinter removed from one of my cheeks. All right, that's my story.
That'll do it. Yeah, okay.
I remember it to this day. All right, next headline. You ready, Ben?
Yes, sir.
Ben wrote his third book while living in a tree for 277 days.
That is untrue. That is just something you made up, John.
That is something I made up.
But it could have happened.
It sounds like something Ben would do, right?
Yeah. In fact, I might do that just because you said it.
So we're going to revisit this and it'll be like, well, that is true.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Next headline. While homeless, Ben and his parrot performed at Lincoln Center.
That is true. Similar to the Katharine Hepburn story, same period of time. I had done a benefit at Lincoln Center in 1993.
Yeah.
It was 1994, and we didn't have the internet fully up and running yet. So we had these things called a Rolodex. Mm-hmm. And a Rolodex is kind of like business cards on a circle.
I just got rid of my Rolodex about 5 years ago.
Oh, my God. It hurt, didn't it?
Yes.
Didn't it hurt?
I still had numbers. In fact, I looked through it and there were old numbers of friends I haven't talked to in years. And I put them on my computer. I still haven't called them yet.
So I'm going through my Rolodex and I see, oh, right, that special events director. I did that thing with her. Now, I am really desperate for cash at this point because I've just spent everything that I have to get this apartment to have a home. You know, I'm building myself from the ground up. Yeah. So I call this person up and I say, I'm this guy, I did this benefit with you last year. She says, I remember you. And I say in the payphone that I'm talking to, you did the right thing the wrong way. Now I'm talking to Lincoln Center. Lincoln Center, for those of you who don't know, it's arguably the preeminent arts institution in the United States. So I am talking to them because I helped them raise money for their theaters and so on the year before. And I'm telling them that what they did was well-spirited, but done completely wrong. And they thought that was really interesting that somebody should seemingly be insulting them, but actually have a plan to do it better. So I went in, they said, okay, bright guy, what's your idea? And I said, this, that, the other. And they said, that's a pretty good idea. And I ended up producing Stomp for them.
Oh.
Stomp is
I remember Stomp in the 80s or 90s.
Yeah, and they're still in the same theater. They've been running for 25 years.
Wow.
This was their very first appearance outside of that theater in the United States, was at Lincoln Center. So we brought them in. We built their special stage out of Masonite. We even were on the news that night. We got ABC News to do a live broadcast at 11:27 during 11 o'clock news because they're right across the street from Lincoln Center. When the producer of the news crew came in and they're running live, so, you know, everything is right now. There's no tape and we'll cut it later. This is live. She says, hi, who's in charge? I say, I am. She says, I know you're the MC. I just saw you on stage, but who's the producer? I said, I am.
Mm-hmm.
She said, oh, you can talk on the phone as well as perform? And I said, well, yeah. And she said, okay, Mr. Wells, where do you want my camera? That night, I had this great gala at Lincoln Center and on TV and everything. And then I went back to living in my friend's garage.
That was fact. Or something John just made up.
I did that. So I had, well, A, I wanted to do it. B, it was a good show. C, I was right. And D, I now had a Lincoln Center producing credit.
Yeah.
Which means something in the business. I worked at Lincoln Center to get a Lincoln Center credit. So, and it worked because the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council that was destroyed in 9/11, they hired me to bring Stomp as well to the Buskers Festival of 96. Mm-hmm. And then I got a 20-week development deal in Seattle because of what I had produced for the Buskers. I mean, it did snowball in my little arty cocoon way.
Right. That job in itself didn't pay, but the idea that you did the job.
Yes. And in fact, Cirque du Soleil called me in very seriously as a producer and said, we'd like to talk to you about what you're doing. And we think you're a guy with ideas. And I said, great. You know, how would this work out with us? And I mean, I was basically taken seriously as a producer, not as a act trying to get hired.
Right.
That was fun because and you are too. Magicians are master organizers.
Yeah.
I mean, John, all the stuff in your car right now that you have to go out and do a show with, how many other people could assemble that package?
If you'd seen my setup, other magicians go, oh, it's so easy. You fold this down, you fold that over, and all of a sudden everything's all compact. And yeah.
Yeah. And it only took you 30 years to figure it out.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I tell the story about when I first started doing this, I would bring in 3 or 4 trips to a school or to a library or something, because that's just what I did. And I've taken those exact props, knocked them down into 2 small cases that go together and just roll in together.
Amazing. Well, see, one of the things that why I was so interested in meeting you and talking to you is that as a full-time pro, I once wrote in an article, I'm a full-time professional magician. My back always hurts.
Yeah.
And Michael Amar wrote into that. And he's like, wow, I've heard the name Ben Robinson for years in the college circuit, but now I know he's really a pro. It's like, oh, you have back problems? Oh, welcome to the club.
Oh, yeah. I tell everybody I do the show for free, but I load in and out. That's what I charge you for.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons that I'm doing this podcast is because I love doing it. I love meeting people like you, but I can do it without getting up at 5 in the morning and getting into my car and going loading up a show and doing the show, which is fun.
Sure.
And then downloading the show and then driving home.
It's exhausting. And I admire you for conquering Southern California. And I don't say that in any patronizing way. I am deadly serious. When I was a kid, I thought, oh, magician, young forever. As you get older, you get younger. Merlin ages backwards. Look at George Burns or Dave Vernon. They're both slugging down gin into their 90s and smoking cigars. These guys are indestructible, and magic keeps you young. And Bob Hope died at 101. And so, you know, it's that old vaudevillian blood that carries you through. Oh, wait a minute. Gee, it's the 21st century. Oh, gee, wait, it's 2018. Oh, wait, gee, you went to Mount Everest for 3 months. Oh, wait, you've punished your body in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Oh. So this leads into writing, which is that what happened was in 2014, I'd had a medical challenge and something where I was kind of knocked out of the box for a little while. And our good friend Paul Rampani said to me,
"Yep,
Ben, look, if you're not out there gigging, why don't you stay home and do a little writing because you've got great stories and you've had a lovely career and you should tell people what you did." And I thought, why would anyone care what I have done with my life? So I wrote an article on Wonder that led to a second, which led to a third. And he said, look, why don't you double the size of it to 16,000 words or whatever it became. And we could do it as a small book. And that became the first book called The Importance of Wonder. And pretty much out of the gate within the first 2 weeks, we had about 16 positive reviews of Amazon, all of which were not solicited. They just showed up and people really dug it. And I thought, wow, what a surprise. This little 68-page book on wonder actually has an audience. And and Paul said, good for you. Well, now it's 2016 and I'd been felled by illness again. So it's 2 years later. And it was this time much more serious. I had pneumonia.
Oh.
And as you know, you can't fly when you have a pneumonia. And I had a gig in Switzerland. I really wanted to go do the gig in Switzerland, but the doctor was saying, if your lungs aren't clear, you're not getting on that plane. It's that simple.
Yeah.
That's great heartache because you work your whole life to get invitations like this, and then you can't do it because of a little pneumonia. Well, anyway, the pneumonia cleared up. I went off and I came back and Paul said, what are you writing? And I said, I'm just writing these stories, knocking it out on a plane of just these things I know, but I don't know how they're connected. And he said, well, send it to me. So I did. He said, this stuff is great. Double the size of it and we'll do another little book. So we did. And that became Artful Mindfulness. In the book, I give examples like Brian Hegland, who is a very well-known screenwriter. One of his first movies was called Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when this major character named Ezekiel is mentioned, and he's a serial killer or something in the movie, they find this picture of Ezekiel. Well, the picture is of the writer of the movie. You know, he stuck his own face in his own movie. But you wouldn't know that unless you were a sleuth like me. You see, what the writer is saying is, I'm hiding in plain sight.
We just went full circle, hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, exactly. Have you heard the thing about The Godfather? Every time an orange is presented by one character to another, or you see an orange, within a minute or two, you're going to see bloodshed.
No, I did not know that.
Go back and watch The Godfather, and you will all of a sudden see this mechanism that Coppola put in the movie very specifically to trick your brain to let you know on an unconscious level. This is what I'm telling you. You know something without knowing you know it.
Mm-hmm.
Magicians do this all the time. Ventriloquists do this. Jugglers do this. Dramatists do this. The second book was called Artful Mindfulness. That Paul said, are you done? I said, no, I think I've got another one in me. He said, about what? And I said, well, if you can have artful mindfulness, you can have mindful artfulness. And he goes, great, do it. And that book became three times the size of the other two. It's like 300 pages. And we found out something fascinating because you can find out through algorithms and buying patterns what other people are buying. In fact, you know, when you go to Amazon, you click on something, it says, oh, people who clicked on this also looked at all these other things, right?
That's right. And now there's retargeting where not only is it Amazon exclusive, if you click on something on Amazon, you'll see it in your Facebook feed, and then you'll see it on your Google page. You'll see it everywhere.
So we figured out that something like 70% of the people who were buying that book for $25 had also spent between $10 and $20 on buying something about Bill Hicks. So we discovered that, oh my God, the Hicks fans are buying this book for the one chapter on Bill Hicks, who, if you don't know out there in listening land, he was a comedian who lived from 1961 to 1994. He died of pancreatic cancer.
One of the great comedians of our time. In fact, if you talk to any comedian, they'll mention in the greats, Bill Hicks as one of them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's right up there with Mark Twain. Very commonly referred to as the greatest comedian of his generation. And we decided, because I had twice the amount of material that was in the book, so I said, well, gee, that's rough. We shouldn't be selling something for $25 for only 32 pages. Let's pull that chapter, and I can beef it up with all the stuff I didn't put in the book, and I can get one of my celebrity friends to write a foreword, and we'll excerpt it. We'll sell it for less than half the cover price, which is what we did.
Tell us about the world premiere of Hiding in Plain Sight.
The world premiere is December 20th in Athens, Georgia, at the Foundry.
And I will be performing on stage at 7:30. The A-Train Band comes out at 8. Now, the great thing is my book, Hiding in Plain Sight, is part of the show. It will be available for purchase. And this will be the only opportunity to receive, if you buy a book, you could have me sign it. But even more important than my signature, the artist who did the cover will be at that show, and she will sign it as well. So in resale value alone, you're making money.
Beautiful. Well, thanks, Ben, for doing my show. You were great.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure's all mine. I appreciate you being here and taking all this time for me.
Okay. Well, I hope to meet you in person. I'll get those books right out to you.
Thank you, sir. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye. Bye-bye. And thanks to all my Variety artists. If you found this podcast valuable, share it with your friends or on your social media. That's how we can create an entire Variety Arts revolution. Also, make sure to get your free audiobook from audible.com. Just go to thevarietyartist.com/book to get your first book for free. You can reach me at my email at john@thevarietyartist.com or join my Facebook group at The Variety Artist, where you can ask me to ask questions of our guests. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist. But until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.